Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Gas prices are on the rise. The national average price for a gallon of gas is $3.84. Here in California, it's $4.34, and prices are expected to go up. Politicians and pundits are playing the blame game. Who's to blame for the high prices? But what do the facts actually tell us? Today's guest, Michael Clare, says we better get used to the high prices. They're here to stay. In his latest Tom Dispatch piece, he writes that the principal cause of higher prices cannot be reversed. The pivotal shift has been brought by the disappearance of relatively accessible and inexpensive petroleum. The problem is that oil is now nearly gone. Michael Clare pioneered the concept of the resource wars back in the 90s. He's professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College and author of the new book, The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. And Michael joins us from New York City. Hi, Michael. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm pleased to be with you today.
Well, it's great to have you. And we're also joined by Kevin Hall, economics correspondent with McClatchy Newspapers. In one of Kevin's latest pieces about oil speculation, he reports that demand for oil and refined products, including gasoline here in the U.S., is actually down sharply from last year, so much that the U.S. has become a net exporter of gasoline because it's unable to consume all that it makes. Oil prices are rising, thanks again, in no small part to rampant financial speculation on top of fears of supply disruptions. Kevin Hall's pieces run in many papers, including the Sacramento Bee and the Modesto Bee. And Kevin joins us from Washington. Hi, Kevin. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rose.
So, Kevin, I have to say, I had no idea that demand for oil is actually down sharply. According to the latest numbers, U.S. oil consumption has declined a little bit in recent years from an all-time high of more than 20.9 million barrels in 2005 to just over 19 million barrels a day in 2010. And you report that the U.S. is now an exporter of gas because people aren't consuming everything that it makes. So what factors are driving up the gas prices if the U.S. is exporting oil?
Yeah, a couple other things, just to update that number even a little bit further. Over the last 4 weeks, according to the most recent EIA report, which is the Energy Information Administration, the total product supplied over a four-week average, which is a more accurate indicator, is about 18.3 million barrels a day. So it's actually down from that. So one trend is we're consuming less, and part of that story is the economic downturn. Part of the story is increases in fuel efficiency, hybrid cars, and things of that sort. But there's another part of this, too, and that's the production. Our own domestic production, too, has helped. The other more recent Today in Energy, I guess, which was the March 19th. It's also a weekly publication that they put out. That would be today, wouldn't it? They said that U.S. crude oil imports last year fell to the lowest level in 12 years, down 12% from the peak in 2005. But the EIA says higher domestic oil production and decreased consumption of petroleum products reduced Americans' refiners' purchases of foreign crude. So we've got that trend going, that we're producing more of our own oil, we're also consuming less of it, and then you look around and you ask yourself, why are oil prices going up? Well, over the last several years, we've had a bunch of different narratives, none of which proved to be true. One of them was, well, it's the weak dollar, we have to have, the Saudis have to make up for it, so, that's why prices are going up. Then the narrative was, well, commodity prices move inverse to the stock prices. So when the stock market was down, commodity prices were going up, and that was the explanation. And then the explanation was, well, markets need price signals. If we simply had more American production, the price signals would bring the price down of oil. Well, today oil is sitting at $106 a barrel of crude oil on the NYMEX midday trading, and each one of those narratives has kind of gone by the wayside. So the one firm thing that has happened is 70% of all oil contracts today are traded by financial players, not end users of oil. Historically, the average has been the reverse. 30% was speculation, 70.
You spoke to Fadel Gett, a 30-year veteran of energy markets and an analyst at Oppenheimer, and he said, quote, speculation is now part of the DNA of oil prices. You cannot separate the two anymore. I still remain convinced oil prices are inflated.
Yeah. I think because there is an element of speculation in and of itself is not a bad thing. and it's all, you know, it adds what's called liquidity to the markets. It allows you to find a midpoint price, kind of between the technical term is price discovery. A buyer and a seller get together, and in the marketplace, they find that price where things should be valued. But if the ball field isn't level and you've got 70% of the traders being financial, and you have a new view that commodities, which used to be a hedge against price shifts, are now being treated like an equity, a stock that you buy and hold, like you would a Walmart stock or Apple stock, these are the changes that are happening in these markets that are distorting the whole process of pricing. Imagine if we priced milk the same way or eggs the same way. There's nothing else we price the way we price oil and gasoline.
Mm. And Michael Clare, what are your thoughts on this? How do you explain the rise in gas prices?
Well, the most immediate feature right now, and what's fueling the speculation that Kevin spoke about, of course, is the fear or the expectation that conflict will break out in the Persian Gulf area, and that will drive prices up even higher. So if oil now is at $110 or $115 a barrel, and you think it's going to go up to $150 or $200 a barrel before too long, it's worth it to buy it now for future delivery and hold on to that oil, expecting you're going to make a very tidy profit come some clash in the Middle East. Now, I don't know whether that's going to happen or not, but there's a lot of expectation that that's the case. So that's what's driving the volatility in the market that Kevin spoke about. But I also think there are other factors that are driving up the price, because oil is a global commodity. If the price isn't set only in the United States. It's set in Europe and Japan and increasingly in China and other developing countries where the demand is rising. So it's a global marketplace with many consumers bidding for whatever supply is available. And behind all of this is what I write about, which is that the easy cheap oil is increasingly disappearing from the market, and more of what we're relying on is very expensive oil, like Canadian tar sands oil, deep water oil, Arctic oil. This is very costly to produce, $60, $70, $80, $90 a barrel to produce, and that price is going to be passed on to the consumer.
And so if demand is down, why is the U.S. exporting oil rather than storing it? And why is there this race to go drill in the Arctic if the U.S. has more oil, if demand is lower than the supply?
Well, of course, these companies like Shell, which is the one that's going to drill up there in the Arctic, these are global companies. They have global markets. Mm. They want to sell to customers everywhere, especially in China and Asia. So they have to go where the oil is. And these international companies, the privately owned companies, are no longer able to operate in places like Saudi Arabia and in Venezuela and Iran, Iraq, because those places, the oil reserves are owned by state-owned companies. So they have to go where they still can drill and own oil, and that's very limited now. It's North America and Europe pretty much are the only places where they could do that. So they have to take second best or third best, and that's the Arctic, very deep waters of the Gulf of Mexico, and really very cruddy stuff like Canadian tar sands. You wouldn't touch that with a 10-foot pole if you had any choice in the matter.
Right.
It's degraded oil, but that's where they're going.
So it's Go ahead, Kevin.
The technology has actually made it accessible, and I think you've also got tar pits in Venezuela, which holds a lot of promise. I think the professor is right that you're going the end of easy. There's certainly the end to easy oil, but I think we're finding with the Bakken reserves in North Dakota, which North Dakota is just surpassed California as the third largest oil producing state in the United States, which is kind of interesting. We're not about to run out of oil. We are certainly running out of easy oil, and the technology has been there. But if I could circle back to this, you know, the fear of Iran conflict, and you know, you'll make a profit if it goes up to $200. Again, that goes back to that point of who is bidding on that oil. It's not the airlines. You know, the small part of that market is the airlines, trucking companies, power utilities who need this oil. It's speculators. Mm-hmm. So it is profit driven. And one way to find out the degree to which speculation is in the DNA is to cap it. Go back to historical standards, even if it's, you know, for a six-month period. You know, politically, I don't see how that happens, but it's important to recognize why the prices are where they are. There's always a narrative. There's always a fear factor that will help you drive up the price. If it's not Iran, it'll be the Sudan or Nigeria. Or you can invent any story you want to drive fear.
And again, Fidel Gett, this man you interviewed, who's an analyst at Oppenheimer, he's testified before Congress and called for regulatory limits on speculation in commodities markets. Who are some of the big players in the oil market on Wall Street?
Well, we have always had a hard time because that information's private. The Commodity Futures Trading Commission doesn't, it lists them, it actually didn't even break out, you know, financial versus end user. It's more complicated because historically, Goldman Sachs or J.P. Morgan or Morgan Stanley, big Wall Street investment banks, were treated as if they were an oil company because they make all what's called over-the-counter bets. They make private two-party bets in an unregulated market, and then they hedge those bets as if they were an oil producer or an oil consumer in the regulated futures market. As of 2006, that data started being broken apart, and now they break it down. The regulator breaks it down between financial speculators, money market funds, which are pension funds that also are very involved in this, end users, and a couple of other smaller categories. So I think we have better data on the broad category as to who these companies are. There was a Wall Street Journal story that they did get leaked, a breakdown of who these players were, and most of the traders were Wall Street intermediaries or Wall Street investment banks.
You also have a piece called Whatever Happened to Task Force on Oil Speculation, and you report that when oil and gasoline prices soared last April, the president announced to fanfare that the Department of Justice would lead a task force designed to root out manipulation of the oil market and gouging of consumers at the gas pump. But since then, the group has only met a handful of times and has never reported to the public.
Yeah, it was introduced to great fanfare last year as prices were rising, and as prices started rising again and we were looking like last year, I started poking around and asking, well, what has that task force done? When has it met? And in fact, their three initial meetings were all right after the creation of the task force. It's done nothing else. Then they've defended it by saying, well, but it's been helping on this Federal Trade Commission look into refineries and whether or not their pricing practices have contributed to price gouging or could be construed as price gouging. So that, you know, they defended it, and then a week later the president said he was reconstituting it, even though they had said it never stopped working. And then the White House spokesman Jay Carney also said, well, it's being reconstituted. So it's kind of hard to figure out how you can reconstitute something that never stopped working, but that is where they stand.
Michael Clare, what do you make of that, this task force that hasn't reported to the public?
Well, this is not something that I follow with the same degree of intensity as Kevin, so I really can't speak to that.
Well, what do you think is, I mean, where does this conversation really need to go right now? Because in the national media, you've got the Republicans spewing rhetoric about gas prices. We need to blame the president for this. And, you know, everybody has an opinion about why gas prices are going up. I found many headlines that ask this very question. I haven't seen that much coverage of speculation and what Kevin is talking about. And then you and your book, I mean, the chapter on the Arctic is just heartbreaking, and we'll talk about that later in the show. But where do you think the focus of this conversation needs to be right now?
Oh, indeed. You know, I think that there's a hidden agenda in this conversation, and that is that the Republicans and their backers in the oil industry and the natural gas industry want to sweep away the restrictions on where they can drill. Mm. They want to drill off the coast of California if they had the chance. They want to drill off the coast of the east coast of the United States. They want to drill in parts of the Gulf of Mexico where they haven't had that opportunity up until now, off of Florida. They'd like to drill in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. So, and in other parts of the United States on federal lands where they haven't had the opportunity. So part of this is a calculated drive to mislead the public into thinking that if the administration gave way on all of these measures, it would bring down the price of gasoline. It would do none of that at all, because it will take years, if not decades, before offshore drilling in the Pacific or the Atlantic will produce any additional oil. And even then, it's unclear that it would lower the price of gasoline. So this is a fraud being perpetrated on the American public.
And if I might add, again, the selling point for why prices, how to get prices down was to boost production and allow, you know, have these signals. And it started under Bush and continued under Obama. But they, the production is reaching, you know, over 9 million barrels a day. U.S. production is, you know, at a 12-year high. There is falling demand, increasing production, and yet there's this perception in the American public that somehow if we had drilled more, prices would be lower. These prices are not taking their cue from supply and demand.
That is Kevin Hall. He is economics correspondent for McClatchy. You can find his latest reporting at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Michael Clare. He's author of the new book, The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. And in his book, he's got sections on invading the Arctic, deep shore oil and gas, tar sands, shale gas, and other unconventional hydrocarbons. And later in the show, we will talk about what it would look like if these companies actually did drill in such a pristine place like the Arctic. And we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on rising gas prices? Why do you think this is happening? What has really struck you about the national conversation you're hearing? And are you hearing much about oil speculation and a really good explanation of why this is actually happening? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. We will also talk about alternatives. Are you hearing any conversations about alternatives to oil? You can leave a comment at yourcallradio.org so others can see it, or you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Molly in Monterey. Hi, Molly. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much. Yeah, there are a couple things. One is I wonder what the actual cost of a barrel of oil would be if all the environmental damage costs were included. I wonder if we made the speculators take physical possession of the oil, if that could change anything. And also, is it possible that the U.S. government could get into building refineries, since I hear there's a refinery limit? I'll take my answers off the air.
All right, thank you, Molly. What are your thoughts on this one, Michael? How much would a barrel of oil cost if it included costs that the damage to the environment?
You know, that's a hard question to answer precisely because there are so many costs that might have to be factored in. If we include the cost of climate change and all of the disasters associated with climate change, the cost would be astronomical, and it's borne not by the user of gasoline or the producer of gasoline. It's borne by the federal government and the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and all kinds of other ways it's passed on. But we don't see it as a product of automobile use. But the costs of that are mammoth. But there are the more immediate costs. BP is expected to have to spend somewhere between $20 to $40 billion for the cost of the cleanup of the Deepwater Horizon disaster. And I don't know how you would factor that out of the production per barrel. I'll have to do that after we finish, but it's a substantial amount.
And you report that if something like that happened in the Arctic, who knows how much it would cost, because it could take days to get the proper equipment up there.
Months. Before they can get that under control, because they don't have the kind of capacity, the infrastructure in the Arctic to drill a relief well, which they were able to do finally to shut down the Deepwater Horizon leakage, the Macondo well it was called. They simply don't have that sort of infrastructure in the Arctic that they had in the Gulf of Mexico.
For your listeners, Rose, also, there's a very good story in the Wall Street Journal today about Brazil and Chevron and the Chevron spill. Brazil is not letting the Chevron country president leave while they're fighting over the spill. And it's an interesting piece because it lays out both sides of the argument, and it goes back to BP and how BP responded and how questions of whether Chevron, in fact, was being scapegoated or whether they actually didn't do a sufficient job in containing the leak. But it points to the fragility of these ecosystems. I'm a little heretical on this. I actually think the technology has improved a lot, that the drilling part of it, despite high-profile accidents on a net, is kind of like, you know, aside from the that, Miss Lincoln, how did you like the play? I mean, obviously the BP spill weighs heavily on everything, but I think the technology has improved a lot. I think, as the professor noted, the global climate change is really the cost variable that really, really matters and is being felt, many argue, already. Molly asked also about whether or not taking possession would make any difference. And one of the proposals that has been floated by some of the regulators is maybe if we at least required a percentage of this to be taken possession, maybe that would put an end to it. Because this trend, by the way, is not just in oil. We've documented how it's happened in cotton, in coffee. Pick your commodity. And scarcity, perceptions of scarcity is what drives us. If you can reduce your inventories to show that it looks like coffee is tight and that maybe a rain will affect coffee flows, then suddenly prices shoot up and we as consumers are all paying for this.
Hmm. All right. Well, thank you for the call, Molly. Let's hear next from Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. It's a little difficult to understand some of this with regard to, say, Obama's reaction to this. Mm. I mean, if these facts are known, and it seems to me that they are widely known, I can go on the Internet and Google this information, oil exports, oil imports, gasoline exports, and I can come up with the same information that your guests have. And clearly, if the Republicans are beating this drum that we need to explore more in the United States, but we're actually exporting gasoline and our capacity is up in terms of production, I'm not sure why Obama isn't saying more about this with regard to these facts. That's one thing. excuse me. The other thing is, it seems strange to me that speculation would be a major factor. I can see that happening. But if in fact these other factors are in play now, I'm wondering just how much speculation plays versus these other factors with regard to the export and the oil production being put up. And I'm wondering also, going back to Obama, if in fact there are Wall Street firms involved in the speculation, well, Obama got a fair amount of campaign money from Wall Street, and I'm wondering if that isn't part of the problem with regard to the fact that he's not speaking out and laying out the facts. Because my feeling is that if most Americans knew that American companies were exporting gasoline, diesel oil, and other products from petroleum, I think they'd be fairly irritated about the fact that gas prices are going up, and that's a major factor.
Yeah, I should clarify that most of those refined fuel export products is actually diesel. There is gasoline as well, and it's increasing, but diesel is the broadest part of that. So the clearest reason why Obama is silent on this is he's got a real problem. Oil production has increased exponentially under his watch. He's actually been together with Bush, have been joined at the hip in generating tremendous amounts of new domestic production. But he can't argue that because it goes against his base. So he gets none of the benefits and all of the blame.
Well, that's a good point. And we have to go to break, but I'd love to have Michael also comment on that. We're talking today about why gas prices are on the rise. Today's guest, Michael Clare, says we better get used to it. They're here to stay. Kevin Hall, economics correspondent for McClatchy, has been writing about speculation. And we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org so others can read it. And we'll be back after this.
Area high school students preparing for their post-school careers in hospitality, law, health science, and other avenues are looking to develop their talents with summer internship programs. If you'd like to take on a summer intern at your local business or nonprofit, we have all the information you need about summer internships on our website at kalw.org. That's www.kalw.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow, Holly Kernan will have a conversation with Tracy McMillan, author of The American Way of Eating, Undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farm Fields, and The Dinner Table. For nearly a year, Tracy worked, ate, and lived alongside the working poor to find out how Americans eat when price matters. So why do we eat the way we do, and how can we change our habits? And we decided to change Thursday show to focus on the murder of unarmed 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. He is the African-American young man who was walking home with Skittles and iced tea and was shot by the neighborhood vigilante Greg Zimmerman, who is still walking free. So we will have a conversation about this Thursday. And if you've got any ideas, what can we really add to this conversation? We'd love to hear from you. Feedback at yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about why gas prices are on the rise. In California, it's about $4.34. Prices are expected to go up, possibly $5 by summer. Today's guest, Michael Clare, says high gas prices are here to stay. There's a disappearance of relatively inexpensive petroleum. That oil is now nearly gone. Michael Clare is author of the new book, The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. He's professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College. And you can find information about his book and his latest Tom Dispatch piece at our website, yourcallradio.org. Kevin Hall is economics correspondent for McClatchy. His pieces run in the Sacramento Bee, the Modesto Bee, and many other papers across the country. And one of his latest pieces is about oil speculation. He also reports that demand for gas is actually down, and the United States is now an exporter of gasoline because it's unable to consume all that it makes. So if you'd like to join us, we actually have full lines. We'll get a line open in a couple minutes, 866-798-8255. You can leave a comment at yourcallradio.org, and I'll get to it in just a couple minutes. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. So, Michael Clare, Greg wanted to get your comment on President Obama's response or lack of response. And before the break, Kevin said that on this issue, he's kind of connected to George W. Bush because there's so much oil being produced at the domestic level. What are your thoughts on that?
He certainly has followed on most of the things that the Republicans have asked of him, but it's still not enough. They want even more. And it's not just what they want of him. I think they're using these energy issues as the driving wedge in the efforts to unseat him in the coming electoral campaign. And, of course, the issue here is jobs. So all of these issues are being used to accuse President Obama of standing in the way of creating new jobs. A good case in point is the Keystone XL pipeline, which will bring, if it's built, when it's built, will carry tar sands oil or oil sands oil, whatever you want to call it, from Canada to Texas and Louisiana for refining. And this is said to create, if you listen to cable television advertising, is going to create hundreds of thousands of new jobs and provide oil for the United States. None of this is really true, but this is going to be a drumbeat of the campaign as a way of making Obama look like he's anti-jobs and anti-growth and anti-energy, even if it's not true. So he's under enormous pressure on these issues to demonstrate his determination to create jobs, to be responsive to the energy needs of the country. And he's in a tight corner.
Well, he's going this week to the Oklahoma town that's the southern starting point of TransCanada's Keystone XL pipeline to talk about his energy policies. Do you think that the Keystone eventually will be built?
I think it will be built, probably along a different path than the one originally planned, which was going to cross the Ogallala Aquifer in Wyoming and other western states, posing a very significant threat to the water supply of much of the western part of the U.S. West. And I think they'll have to reroute it to avoid that danger. But I suspect he'll be under so much pressure that he'll be forced to build it. But it's not going to solve any of our economic problems if it is built. And the southern leg is going to go ahead.
All right. Well, thank you again for the call. Let's hear from Michael in Oakland. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you. The only way that oil companies can make record profits is if the prices are higher than their costs. And clearly, what they have done is tried to create artificial slowdowns in supply by export and from what I've read, by shutting down refineries. And you create a slower, for whatever excuse, a slower supply, and then you gouge the market. This is capitalism. So you charge whatever the market can bear. And notice that whenever there's been a public outcry and threat of investigation by Congress and so on of these price rises, the oil companies have backed off, and the prices have gone down. And once the public outrage is quieted, they start building the prices up again.
Yeah, and Congress, they can't even end oil subsidies in Washington, D.C. And I'm really glad you brought this up, because can you explain, Kevin, how this works? ExxonMobil posted $41 billion in profits last year. They had the largest profits of the big five oil companies. This translates to about $5 million an hour, or if you want to break it down, $1,300 every second. So can you explain how this works? How is Exxon making so much money?
Well, I think it's the difference between, well, one of the things we've been asking, and without a good answer, is you have to break Exxon down to its components, and there's a refining division. And if you look at, I've been looking at the Securities and Exchange Commission filings by the major refiners for 2011 and looking at their profits and how they're describing their profits. And you know, it's a technical term called the crack spread, and basically, you know, the ability how much they have to pay for oil and how much they can sell it for. It's not clear the degree to which they're winning on their oil futures trading, and that's reducing the prices. It's really hard to sift through, but the bottom line is they're making, you know, the refiners all made record profits last year at a year where, very similarly to this year, you had this big run-up in prices with no, you know, with the threat. I guess last year it was supposed to be Libya going offline. This year it's the chance of Iran. And they've always said, well, we can't pass all this on to consumers. We have to eat some of this. But their SEC reports show they didn't in fact eat that. So it kind of begs the question, if the airlines and all these other people who are so dependent on oil are screaming about limiting speculation, and the only major user of oil that isn't screaming are the refineries, you know, I think that speaks for itself.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. We have an email from Leslie who says, since, as your guests point out, oil is traded on the international market and sold to the highest bidder, what could the Republicans possibly mean when they talk about drilling for, quote, American oil, as if the oil under American soil or water somehow belongs to American consumers, so that the more oil the international corporations find, the less we're dependent on foreign oil? And why do the Democrats and or the experts constantly not point this out, or is this something I don't understand? Michael Clare, how would you respond to that?
Well, I really appreciate that's a very intelligent question.
Yeah.
I wish more people would ask it, but it's quite correct. Oil is an international market. Now, a lot of what's produced in this country is refined in this country and sold in this country, but not at prices that are different from prices that are sold elsewhere. There is a gap, as I'm sure Kevin can explain, between the Texas West Intermediate price, which is a standard American price of oil, and the price set in London of $10 or $15. It varies because of the higher costs of production and transport and whatever in the Eastern Hemisphere markets. But still, the prices correlate pretty closely, and we pay this international price for wherever we get the oil, because the big refiners, the big suppliers, they get oil from everywhere, and they mix it all together. They mix domestic oil and imported oil. We still get 40 or 50% of our oil is still imported, and it's all mixed together, and they pay different prices for it, and then they sell it at whatever price they can get from consumers.
And go ahead, Kevin.
I guess just one curiosity in global markets is, although, yes, we get now about 48% of our oil from imports, you break that down more narrowly, and most Americans are probably not aware that almost all of that 48% comes from Canada first, Mexico second, Venezuela third. So it's all with two of the three very friendly governments, one obviously not. But that is just how strange it is the way this product is priced. You know, you would think we're the largest consumer, we're one of the largest producers, and we're supplied by two stable neighbors, and yet Iranian oil, of which we do not buy any, is somehow driving our prices up. I mean, I just really think we haven't had a proper think through of how this product is priced. It wasn't always priced this way.
And since you brought up Europe, David writes, can you talk about gas price regulation in Europe, where the cost of gas is about double the price as it is in the States? And do you think increased gas costs in the States might lead to more innovation? What do you think, Michael?
Oh, I certainly think that would be the case. If prices remain high, everybody will grumble, and I understand why, but it will force people to make individual choices that would probably be for the good. They'll be forced to turn in their clunkers for their gas guzzlers for more fuel-efficient cars. And in fact, that is exactly what's happening. As Kevin said earlier, the fuel efficiency of the American car fleet has dropped in the past few years, partly because so many people are turning in less efficient cars for more efficient cars, and that will increase in the future as standards increase, which is the plan. So that's a good thing. It would be helpful if more and more of the taxes that we spend on gasoline, a lot of this is taxation that's added to the price, and in Europe the taxes are much, much higher. If more of that was invested in user-friendly, efficient public transportation, so that people would actually be able to have a decent alternative to using their cars and being stuck on freeways all the time.
Right. Kevin.
Obama's been beaten around the head and shoulders for a statement he made, I guess, on the campaign trail, saying that there's a silver lining in high prices, and that the good thing about high prices is it forces innovation, it forces alternatives, and I think that's clear as day. That's getting distorted to say he wants higher oil prices. The truth is, the best thing that could ever happen to us is actually higher oil prices, because, look, it brought us the hybrid, how quickly that adjusted. If you look at how companies are preparing for the future, Ford Motors is now making on one single manufacturing platform can make the same car, conventional fuel, hybrid, and all electric. They're hedging their bets. They think this oil price thing may very well turn and force changes their position to make a move. I think there are a lot of things. A homework assignment for your listeners, try to find online a report by Amory Lovins of the Aspen Institute. It's called Winning the Oil Endgame. It was done under contract for the Defense Department about ways to, if we were forced into a crisis where we didn't have access to fuel, how could we quickly change gears and get to much smaller fuel consumption. Very thorough report, everything from carbon composite cars, light vehicles. Today in our office, we had a colleague and I sat down with DuPont's biofuels president, the president of that division. Fascinating. That's not an oil company. That's a chemical company. They see a big future in biofuels. So there are a lot of reasons to be optimistic.
Do you agree with that, Michael? Are there a lot of reasons to be optimistic?
I think that the innovative, that the technical capacity of the United States is infinite. And I travel to a lot of universities when I travel around giving talks on these subjects, and I meet young people, engineers, scientists, who are working on very creative solutions to our energy problems and our transportation problems. So I know that the creative energy is here. The technical capacity is here in this country. What is lacking is the finances and the support to move from laboratory-scale projects to full-scale commercial development of many of these ideas. And that's what we need next.
And that is Michael Clare. He's author of the new book, The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. He is also a professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College. We're also joined by Kevin Hall, economics correspondent for McClatchy. And we have about 10 minutes left. And I'd like to go through a few calls since so many people have been waiting patiently, and then we'll get responses. Let's hear from Jason in Palo Alto. Hi, Jason.
Hi. So, quick question for you, and you guys really alluded to this in the last segment here. How do we change the conversation so that it's a positive conversation?
Yes.
In the sense that when oil prices go up, we're actually breeding the innovation that's going to bring about the end of oil. And so instead of, and we always do this, we say, oh, oil's at $5, this is killing me. But it's really not. In the long run, Europe's been at double the price we are. And it's driving. You see Germany adopting so many more renewable resources because of the higher prices. So how do we change that conversation here in the States to where a higher price is actually something we should have to drive innovation?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I will ask that in just a minute. Thank you for calling, Jason. Let's hear from Mike in San Francisco. Hi, Mike.
Hi, thanks for having me. My question would be, what's like the biggest call? I mean, basically we're getting screwed by the oil companies. Because every time I hear that they're being reported on the news, they're making record profits. And obviously they're not passing that, you know, down to us, the consumer.
And so you'd like to know?
Like, I mean, they're obviously raising the prices. You know, it's up to them to raise the prices. So I was wondering what would Congress do us.
Okay.
What the government would
do. What Congress could do here. Okay, thank you, and we'll get a response in just a minute. Let's go next to Peter in Watsonville. Hi, Peter.
Oh, hello. Thank you for taking my call. It seems to me that the problem here is the free market, and as always, it's the 99% that kind of get crushed in this. Why not take oil off the board as a trading commodity for companies other than producing companies and consuming companies? And just take the middleman, the speculator, out of it.
So take oil off the board.
Yeah,
completely.
So take it off the board. You know, treat it as a national security interest. Mm. And if it doesn't work simply in America because there are foreign traders doing the same thing,
right.
Get together with some form of regulatory body like you find in the nuclear industry, and simply ban traders who are simply in there for speculative purposes.
All right. Well, thank you for that question. And we'll take two more. Let's hear from Harvey in Berkeley. Hi, Harvey.
Hi, Rose. I'd like to suggest when possible. I feel the gentlemen are right that the oil companies and the car companies are colluding to push people into hybrids at 50, 60 miles a gallon instead of 10 to 20 or 20 to 30. And I have an answer here. It turns out once you have the equipment, like when you buy an internal combustion engine, you need the fuel, gasoline. But if you buy solar panels, once you buy the equipment, the fuel is free for the next 20 years, sunlight. It's free fuel for 20 years, so if you go to plug-in vehicle tracker, you'll see all the new electric cars, and you can plug them into your solar panels for free fuel for 20 years.
Well, thank you. Actually, the Chronicle had a front-page article yesterday, I believe it was on the front page, anyway, in the paper yesterday, about plug-in cars. It was actually very interesting, so we'll put a link to that piece. We have an email, actually, from Carlton on this issue. Personally, I would like to have an alternative to gasoline, but we had to make a deposit and then wait months just for the privilege of owning a hybrid, and if we want to convert it to a plug-in, we'll have to shell out another $16,000, which we don't have. Thank you for the email. It's a great point to make, Carlton. And let's hear from one more caller, Marcia in San Francisco. Hi, Marcia.
Hi. Excellent program. Very timely. It's not just cars, and it's not just gasoline. If I go to buy a new dishpan, most of the stuff offered for sale is made of oil. If cars are getting bigger, everything's getting bigger. A baby stroller is now made of mostly oil products, and they're enormous. We don't need this. My car is 23 years old, still gets 45 miles to the gallon, passes a smog test without any problem. It was the cleanest car made the year I bought it. And it's, I don't know how to explain this. It's not just gasoline. It's not just cars. Oil is everywhere. I can hardly buy clothing without it.
Right. That's a great point. And this is something we don't really talk much about, Michael, is that it's not just the gas that we put in our cars.
No, absolutely. And your caller is quite right that oil is used for many other things. What worries me, and what I found when I was doing research on my book, The Importance of Oil in Agriculture, the whole farming system in the United States is heavily dependent on petroleum for heavy equipment, you know, the farming equipment, for trucking farm products to markets thousands of miles in some cases, for pesticides, for herbicides, for all kinds of inputs. And this is what's driving up the prices of food. It's not only oil that's rising, but food products, which are really a byproduct now of oil. So everything is tied together. And we're going to have to think in the future, if oil eventually becomes more scarce, what's more important? Is it our cars or is it the food on our table? But that's only the beginning of this conversation.
Right. Well, and we have a number of people emailing saying, I think gas prices should go up higher because that would force us to find alternatives. So what about that very important question Jason called in with? How can we actually change this conversation so we actually talk about alternatives to oil? And Michael, you write about this in your book.
Yes, well, I think there are a number of things that we have to say, and partly I think we have to combat the notion that a future of high-priced oil and less oil is necessarily a bleaker future. If we think about a future where there's fast, efficient, user-friendly public transportation available everywhere, people will choose to use it, because partly because of the higher prices of oil. Last year had the highest public transit use in America in a very long time. And where there is good public transportation, people are flocking to it. If we had a lot more of that and people saw the advantages of fuel efficiency and living in cities and communities that were linked by public transit, this would be a future that would look promising to people, not a bleak future. So the conversation has to be not just about prices and commodities, but about the world that we inhabit, envisioning a world that is a more promising, a more hopeful future. And the caller who talked about solar panels, that's another important part of that. A world in which the sun provides a lot of our energy will add to that image of a more hopeful, creative future for our children in particular.
And Kevin, what role does the media play in trying to have a different kind of conversation? Because Media Matters' latest report about how this is being covered found that, with the exception of NBC, every TV network mentioned expanding drilling as one of the only solutions.
Yeah, I mean, that's the world we live in now, with shrinking newspaper coverage, wire services like Bloomberg that are writing for terminals, not for, you know, people who consume news. And I think that's a big challenge. You know, we've been out there trying to, you know, shake the trees as much as we can. But going back to the earlier question on what we can do, again, as your emailers had suggested, in economics terms, it's called demand destruction. Prices reach a high enough price to which the demand for that product disappears. And I think as prices keep pushing up, and if in fact we're running out of oil, or, you know, the Chinese and Indians and Brazilians are consuming so much of it that it's running scarce, then it will accelerate this drive to technology. And I think that's a good thing. It will happen. And think back to, you know, the Virgin Records and CD stores and how quickly they disappeared in favor of, you know, the iPod and digital technology. The same thing would happen. You know, the infrastructure for electric cars is already in place. All you do is retrofit a gas station and do your fast charge there. I mean, it doesn't take a lot to get from here to there. Does it happen in a disrupted way, or does it happen, you know, over time gradually, is really the question.
And Michael, can you add more solutions to that list, and also respond to Mike's question? He wanted to know what role the government can play in all of this.
Well, first, let me just say one thing about the high price of oil, because it has to be put out there. If people want to see the price of oil drop right away. There's only one way that that's going to happen, and that is if there's peace in the Middle East. Mm. That's the only way that prices are going to drop. If President Obama reaches some kind of accord with Israel and the Iranians and the Europeans to solve the nuclear problem in Iran in a way that everybody can live with, and the fear of war in the Middle East vanishes, then the speculators who've been buying all this oil on the theory that it's going to rise will be stuck with a lot of high-priced oil, and the price will fall. So anything we could do to promote peace in the Middle East is the surest mechanism to get us to lower prices. Mm.
Well, yesterday
people need to know that.
Yeah, well, yesterday was the 9-year anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq.
Well, got a lot of oil out of it, didn't we?
Yeah. So that's important. But in terms of the solutions part, I've come to think that it's less about trying to find some magic fuel that's going to allow us to keep our existing fleet of automobiles on the road, and to think more about ways of getting around that don't rely on large metal boxes on wheels taking us places, because I'm not sure there's a future for that. And we have to think about alternative ways of getting around, and that might mean ways of promoting people living closer together, where public transit makes more sense, or as your caller suggested, having individually distributed solar and wind power that can provide energy for plug-in hybrids, or eventually for hydrogen-powered fuel cell vehicles, which may be the best solution in another decade or so.
Rose, one factor that hasn't been talked about.
And we're almost out of time, Kevin. Go ahead.
Natural gas, the Marcellus Shale, huge amounts of gas is going to transform things. Mm-hmm. I think you're going to see the energy sector, instead of looking at renewables and biofuels, start putting a lot more attention at how do we use natural gas for trucks, for a number of uses. And, the other factors, the energy industry isn't going to go away without a fight.
All right, we'll continue this conversation. Kevin Hall, economics correspondent with McClatchy, and Michael Clare, author of the new book, The Race for What's Left. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks.
And thanks. Thank you. Thanks for your phone calls and emails. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. How is the corporate American food system changing? On the next Your Call, we'll speak with Tracy McMillan, author of The American Way of Eating, Undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farm Fields, and The Dinner Table. For nearly a decade, she worked, ate, and lived alongside the working poor to examine how Americans eat when price matters. How do you get good food on the table? Why do we eat the way we do? And how can we change it? It's Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor, and Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.